My name is Maceo.
My name is Puno.
And this is our podcast.
It's fun! With Puno.
And Maceo. Maceo and Puno.
It's Puno and Maceo.
Whatever.
Today, we are going to be talking with my new good friend, Jacob Tobia. Woo! Maceo, you got to watch Jacob and I do stand-up.
Really, it was a really fun night.
That's actually how I know Jacob.
I think it totally relates to what we're talking about because you are someone I've known for years. And
we were Instagram stranger friends.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I have so many of those now.
My first.
Yeah. Really?
Oh. Yeah. Like
Maceo reached out. There are hundreds of thousands of people who know who Puno is, and I was the one who started it all.
Like you're like your first like DM to IRL friend.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
And I texted you were like, "Hey, do you want to hang out?" You knew I was married.
No. You asked me if I wanted to hang out, and you knew you were married. And I was still down thickens, after I found out you were married.
Of course.
Because polyamory is great.
Yeah. I mean, well.
That was actually a joke of ours for a while that Puno was my rental wife.
Yeah.
Whenever I wanted to like look cute with someone at an event, I could definitely bring Puno.
Yeah.
And whenever Daniel didn't want to go to something.
Which
is all the time. I could go.
Yeah, that's the dream situation because I feel like in this town, if you try and make, like, unless your partner is also, so there's two situations. One, your partner's also in, like, the industry or the biz in some way, in which case your relationship is doomed from the start. And then the other option is that your partner's not, and, like, if you try and drag them to all of the things, they'll be like, this is miserable, and I hate it, and then they'll break up with you, or they'll get into it, and they'll be like, I'm going to be in the industry too, and then it'll cause a rift, and then they'll break up with you. So, like, alternating and, like, not bringing your actual partner too often to stuff is, I think, a really smart strategy to sustain a marriage.
Mm-hmm. We did the algorithm and those were all the different consequences. And we were like, we got to do this other one, the rental wife husband situation.
Like your like official arm candy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But then
and
I release.
It's about the optics too. Right. And
oh, like, we look so cute together.
I know y'all have delicious optics.
Thank you.
You know, it's like, there's like, I'm getting really into like shipping these days. You know, like on Twitter, like when there's like fandoms and they ship characters. And like, I ship the two of you.
Oh,
you know what
you.
I mean?
Like, greenlit.
Like you're probably like, and you know, it's like shipping. So it's like, it's like, you know, it's harmless. Cause like the showrunner's never going to actually have you date.
Right.
But like we can sort of be like, but what if?
Yes. It's yeah. Totally fan fiction.
Yeah. But it would definitely be Puno and Maceo.
Alphabetically, it would be Maceo and Puno.
That's the show.
It would be Paceo or Muno.
Paceo.
Is Paceo better or Muno?
I like Paceo because it's also Paisley.
Yeah. And I also like Paceo better because the truth is both of our names end in O.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So it's like inserting you in the middle of Puno. I'm really bad. I'm bad.
It's okay.
We're having fun though, so it's like on trend.
It's
like
fun.
We're on theme, right?
It's yeah. Fun.
It's a really great name for a podcast too, because like anytime you giggle, you're like, oh my gosh, we are so our namesake right now. Oh my gosh, we're having fun. Like yeah. We're doing it, everyone.
And if too long goes by without that happening, then we know that episode sucks.
Right. And if it like gets too dark or whatever, you'll be like, this is us boldly going against type, okay?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Shut the fuck up, everybody.
It might be fun. Just let it simmer.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like, why does fun have to always be fun? You know what I mean? Look, I'm just here to cause epistemological crises, okay?
Ooh,
I just
want, epistemological.
That's my favorite word.
I love it. I love it. I love epistemology.
Yeah. It's the one where when you want to sound smart, but you're not like, I mean, I'm speaking for myself, speaking personally from my own personal experience and lived truth. It's like what you say when you like took a few queer theory classes in college and like could vaguely still read the texts, but not really. But you want to sound like you still could. So you like say epistemology every few, you know, days.
Mine is ontological.
Ooh, fuck me up. Yeah.
Yeah. Ontological sovereignty. What?
Stop.
I don't even know what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, can you break down ontological sovereignty for us?
Ontology is the study of being.
Yeah.
And sovereignty is your sort of independence from others. And so if we're going to, like, actually, this is an interesting way to kind of segue into the topic. To have ontological sovereignty is to know and be affirmed in your own existence without it having to be corroborated by
anybody else, others. Outsiders.
It's like the I think, therefore I am shit.
Absolutely.
I am what I am.
It is vision board.
Yeah.
In a mirror.
Yeah. Yeah. Infinitely.
Infinitely. Yeah. Oh, there's a mirror behind it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there's a mood board, and then the mirror's, you know, my mom used to work in a hair salon, so we would always have the two mirrors.
Before she was an artiste.
Yes.
Well, back when she was a different kind of artiste.
Exactly. Hair. Her. Yeah. So also, Jacob just, well, it was just released, but you've known about it for a while, is on the Netflix cartoon She-Ra as, what was
My character's name is Double Trouble.
As Double Trouble.
Oh, okay. So
the first non-binary cartoon character?
Not the first, because like there have been like, I mean, well, A, like the history of cartoon characters, like hella like androgynous, right, gender, like non-conforming.
Sure.
Yeah.
Big Bird.
There's like a million different genders
Big Bird,
in cartoon.
Tweety Bird.
Right. Like what are their genders? You know what I mean?
Tweety Bird, I don't know.
Sylvester Cat, right? Like, is Sylvester like a butch lesbian, or like a dude, or like a fancy gay boy? Like, we don't know.
I don't know. But I definitely think Tweety Bird is non-binary.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, all that is to say, like, the whole, like, first language is kind of, like, ugh. But, like, it is, I think it's, like, one of the first sort of, like, canonically non-binary characters, where it's, like, official in the canon of the show, according to the people who made it, that is the case, right?
Nice.
And even in that, it's not the first, but it's one of the first, and it's a big step forward in terms of, like, a major character, you know, but like that is non-binary, voiced by a non-binary, voice actor, and like really involved in the show, right? Yeah. Like I'm like a key part of sort of the plot of season four.
Right.
It's not like a one episode show up, educate people about pronouns and go. It's like, you know, show up episode two, and like fuck up episodes 2 through 13.
Ooh, right. Yeah.
I like that.
Cause I'm like a shape-shifting mercenary.
Yes.
So I'm very... I really mess with everybody.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, it's fun. It was really, I mean, speaking of which, right? Like, I think that's...
Speaking of fun.
Right. I think that's when I kind of think about where I'm trying to head and how I'm trying to respond to my own impulses and my own, like, goals and where I want to go, I'm trying to let fun guide me a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Because the thing that
Preach.
Was so great.
Fun.
Yeah. Like the thing that was so great about doing voiceover work is that it's the most fun I've ever had making money.
I love voiceover work. This is as close as we're going to get, but
I'd say that.
I mean.
You don't know.
Yeah, you're right.
We could totally have a cartoon.
That's true. Okay, sorry.
We don't even have to change our names. For it to
Look,
be a
I
cartoon.
Can just take that ceiling.
We already have cartoon names. Rick and Morty, Ren and Stimpy, Maceo and Puno.
Right. Puno and Maceo, exactly.
Right.
That's true. Okay, sorry about that. We're going higher than this. So, but yes,
This is our first foray into voice acting, but...
No, I've done it before.
There you go, see?
I used to be an art director, and I casted myself. Right. As a mutant squirrel.
Yeah. Wait. Really?
Mm-hmm. And what? I said, go forth and rock. That's it. I got paid $7,000.
Wait, $7,000?
Yeah.
Was it in a movie?
No, it was in a
How?
It was in a commercial.
Oh, it was commercial.
An Activision
got it.
Commercial that was
okay. I was
also
like,
international.
Right.
It was in Europe too.
Yeah, an international commercial that'll pay $7,000. But you got the part legitimately.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, just like you had to for your audiobook.
I mean, I told them, I was like, I mean, they were like, well, are you cool doing it? And I was like, yeah.
Well, yeah. So
I mean, like, I'm
tell
a really
us about
good
your
reader.
Book and then the audio book.
Yeah. So it's called Sissy, A Coming of Gender Story.
It's a beautiful cover.
Yeah. I got really lucky with my cover designer in-house at Putnam, my imprint, and like, you know, because they send you to sort of like a cover designer internally at Penguin Random House, and you kind of don't necessarily get to control who gets it, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not like they're like, here's the portfolios of 12 of our in-house cover artists, choose which one you'd like, right? They're just kind of like, we assigned it to so-and-so, we're going to send you some stuff later. And I just happened to get assigned to this mustachioed queer gentleman who just like really got it from the get-go.
It's fun. It's pearly, it's pink, it's glitter.
Yeah, we added glitter, and that was actually a big debate in terms of
I don't know why.
Like whether or not we should like do it. I mean, we had to get authorization to add glitter because glitter falls in the category of cover effects, which basically in order to get cover effects, they just have to really like your book and think it's going to sell enough that, and like think that adding the cover effects will be beneficial enough for sales that it's like worth it to like pay the extra money to like put fancy materials in the mm-hmm. cover. So, you know, once we got cleared for cover effects, because of course, mm-hmm. Then we had to decide, you know, what we wanted to do. And glitter was my first instinct, but then I was also like, wait, does that mean I should do it? Or does that mean I should like question it? And so I went down this little rabbit hole of being like, well, we got to get the glitter right, because there is such a thing. There's a way that like you can put glitter on the cover of a book where, and this is about, you know, both the amount of glitter, like the sort of surface area the glitter covers, but also like the actual glitter itself.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like the way the finish.
Sizes and
right.
Stuff.
Right.
You went fine. Iridescent.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So mm-hmm. like, you know, I think what we sort of landed on was like, if we have a glitter that's too kind of, that's like too vibrant, it feels like it's almost apologizing for the book. Right. It's saying like, oh, we have to put a gimmick on this so that you'll buy it. Mm. Right. Like, because it's not worth buying without something shiny on it. So right. Like, here's something shiny. So like you can do it. Mm-hmm. And
scratch it because it smells.
Right. 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 And I think like, you know, so where we landed was the way the thing I love about it is that the glitter, like from far away on a bookshelf, you wouldn't see it. Like if you're just like shopping through Barnes and Noble or whatever, like you wouldn't like notice the glitter. But then when you go up and pick up the book, you're like, oh. And it's only in a few little places. It's like on the jewelry
it's
and on
actually,
the lips.
I'm noticing that same quality is in your eyes.
Thank you. Are we shipping us now?
We can do that. Yeah. We've established what it is.
Right.
Yes. You're shipped.
Yeah.
And you need a third party to ship you. So I
right.
ship you.
Okay, great. Thank you. You can't self-ship.
You can't self-ship.
Don't be presumptuous.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's only like, yeah, it's always got to be third party. Well, so in, we were talking about this with your book because you are next, like who are you next to? Who are you between in your...
When you see yourself on, when you see your book in...
Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble or wherever, right? Mm. Where books are sold.
Yeah.
Where is Sissy, a coming of gender story, positioned next to it? I've actually seen it out in the wild.
Yeah.
And I think I have some, but it's there's alphabetical order, there's right. section type. You know,
right.
Where do you think you see your...
Well, so it's a little, it's different, you know, it varies. It's varied. Like there are some places, there are some bookstores where I've gone in and just been like, I'm so disappointed. Like what the hell? you know, I'll give us, because I feel like probably there's a lot of LA listeners in this podcast. So I'm going to give a specific shaming to Skylight Books.
Oh,
I love them, but I'm like, last time I went in the store, I wasn't turned out. And I'm just saying I would sign it if you turned it out. But like I walked in, it was just normal on the shelf. Like, you know, and I was like, really? I live here. Like, I'm a local author. Like,
yeah.
Come on, Skylight. I yeah. like literally hang out there for fun.
Yeah.
And I
Did
didn't know
you turn
how...
it out?
No, I should have. But I like, I feel like it's one of those things like, you don't want to get caught doing that. Like, and I could have been sneaky, but it was like at my friend's book signing. And I was like, there were a bunch of people there. So I couldn't just like, if there was no one else there, I would have been like,
yeah,
I have turned my own book out.
Yeah, of course. No, I've done it too. I just, you have to be like, it's contextually.
Turn out for what?
Yeah.
For sales. That's what you turn out for.
I've definitely turned my own book out. And I think that, you know, sometimes that makes a difference because sometimes a bookstore is only taking a chance. They're buying 2-3 copies to
right.
see. And if they only buy 2-3 copies and they sell one, that means they're going to buy maybe 2-3
what
more.
If the whole right. What if the whole bookstore was turned out?
I think there
actually
are some bookstores like that.
Some bookstores do that. They
that's
reduce,
like a Blockbuster.
Well, yeah, they reduce the number of books they carry so that they can expose all of them. Then you'd be in an art gallery or a magazine stand.
Or a Blockbuster.
Or a Blockbuster video, which right. their business model apparently didn't work, but it's more
not,
so...
Not because of the turning out.
You know what? They could have just maybe bought like an algorithm to compete with Amazon. And
you don't buy algorithms.
Speak for yourself.
I have a whole collection of algorithms at home.
I've been buying all the finest algorithms that money can buy over the last decade.
Yeah, what are you talking about? Isn't that the entire plot of Silicon Valley?
Yeah. You're buying.
Wait, I love Silicon Valley as opposed to Silicon Valley. Wait, when is that spinoff going to happen? Okay, trademark. Don't steal it. If you steal it, I'm suing you.
It's just a movie. It's just like a show about like breast implants or something.
Yeah.
It's like Nip Tuck meets Silicon Valley.
Well, it's in between. It's in between the Silicon Valley. It's okay. Sorry. Well, okay. So, what's your book about?
We talked about the outside. We talked about where it's placed. Let's talk about the inside.
Although, honestly, I do feel that there's something really special about being like, so we're gonna start with the petty shit, and then we're gonna work our way to something substantive.
Some meaty, yeah.
Yes.
It's like we're like warming up. You know, we're stretching before we go on our run.
Oh, for sure.
And also, I think there's a real stigma in the literary community about like being petty, you know what I mean? Like you're not allowed to acknowledge that it's like an economy, right? You're not allowed to like acknowledge that like trying to sell books and have a career is like also a job and a hustle. You're supposed to just be like, yes, I write.
Well,
pure literature.
I do appreciate that in some context because the actor musician community is desperate.
Yeah, their energy
compared
is desperate.
Compared to authors.
Quietly pretend like they're not tracking the sales.
Right. We all pretend like we don't even know our sales numbers. Yeah. But I think it is interesting that there's, because the thing I don't like about publishing is that this sort of the way that like you perform yourself as a literary person is also like I find super classist because you pretend like you don't care about money because many people who are authors don't.
Well,
right? Like
yeah.
Author is like the sort of marquee career you have after you do a million other things, or it's like the thing that you do when you're already established, mm-hmm. or like, you know, it's like the thing you do because you have someone else supporting you. It's also very like, that's what I've learned in New York. I can be like, oh yeah, my book is available at the Strand. Also, and in LA, I have to be like, my book is available on Audible. And then people will actually go listen to it.
Yeah, that's me.
Right.
That's why I was like, oh, I'm not going to do that.
But that's why I really wanted to do the audiobook. Because I was like, there's going to be a ton of people who are going to consume the book this way. And well, like, it is in my voice, you know, like lyrically. Mm-hmm. I would like it to be actually in the timbre of my real voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it is you. Yes. And right. It is about.
So the book is basically what it does is like the way I describe it, and this is a bit self-aggrandizing, but like we can hold it. And also I have like a New York Times book review to back this up. But like it's sort of like if David Sedaris and Mindy Kaling had a non-binary child and that child sat down and grew up in North Carolina and sat down to write a little memoir.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, because I think, you know, for like the thing that was really important to me in writing it, because it basically chronicles from like, you know, early childhood through my college graduation and kind of how I came to understand like what it meant to sort of be like non-binary, genderqueer, gender nonconforming. You know, there's a gajillion labels, like how to kind of understand myself as like other gendered, mm-hmm. And what it meant to navigate the world in that way. But the thing that was really important to me about it is that I think tonally, there's a lot of tone policing when it comes to sharing trans stories, mm-hmm. right? When it comes to trans people sharing our stories and queer people sharing our stories, there's sort of this sense that you have to present your tone in a certain way, right? In a very kind of like serious, in a very like often sort of like trauma-based,
yes.
right? Like sort of way where you earn your identity because you have to present like this powerful story,
right?
Right. And I actually think that for every time that someone tells that a trans storyteller tells a powerful story like that, which like if that's the story you want to tell, if that's actually like what your heart wants to share, it's beautiful, it's powerful, it is transformative, it does things for the world, it's awesome. But the imperative to always have that tone ends up really stifling a lot of people because mm-hmm. A, it means that your identity has to be the sole focus of your work, right? And B, like it means that there's no space for levity. Mm-hmm. There's no room for sort of tonal inflection, right? And I think as an author, the way I think about my journey tonally is kind of the same way I think about like learning to embrace my like gay voice. You know what I mean?
Ooh, yes.
Like I spent so long of my like, you know, after my voice changed, right? Because when I was growing up, I was like a boy soprano in choir.
But,
no, like for real, I did a boy choir and way higher. I had like a killer soprano range.
Dang.
It was like really sad to lose it because I went from being a diva to being a bass.
Wow. Yeah.
I can't even do it anymore.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I feel like when my voice dropped, it was, and when I tried to like be a dude, you know what I mean? There's this pressure to sort of like, oh yeah, you have to like talk down here. It's sort of monotone and it's like, you know, you keep it down here. And I stopped myself for a really long time from actually exploring the rest of my tone in my voice. And I kept it down here because it was how I would sort of show to the world that like, nah, like I'm not, don't, my gender is not suspicious. It's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I just talk like a dude.
Mm-hmm. This makes me want to talk like that too.
Right. I think it's different for, it would different. It's a different political proposition for you too, I think.
Yeah.
Right. I'm into it. I'm a little turned on. Is that okay?
Can
you ship us?
Yeah.
Maceo, can you ship us?
Now you're shipped.
We've all been shipped now. We're a love triangle. It's
yeah.
great.
Yeah, it's great.
That's what I like.
But yeah, and you know, as I got older, I finally learned to like let myself have my faggy voice, right? Mm. And like let myself have my sibilant S's and go up and down and go all over my vocal range and all of that.
I think what I really liked about reading it, one, I'm not super versed in all of the labels and I'm not really sure everything. So I'm just learning a lot from you and you have a lot of really great articles too. Mm. Like the SEO is bomb. Cause I would just write I would ask the question in Google and then you would have an article. And I was like,
well, good.
But, there's this one part that where you talked about, that why isn't your journey fun? Because it's always in order for you to be taken seriously, or not just you, but like anybody who's going through some kind of going through this, then there needs, it can't be fun. It has to be traumatic. It has to be so serious or it won't be taken seriously. And I really love that because I thought, you know, a lot of the things that you wanted to do were just straight up fun.
Right.
Yeah.
Like the core of my gender is not transgression. The core of my gender is joy and fun, right? The core of my gender is play.
Mm.
That's all I ever wanted
to
do.
All you wanted to do.
Literally all I still want to do.
To me, what's so fascinating about the way you describe it when you use the sort of metaphor of your voice, if we expand that to your identity, isn't that limiting nature of gender as sort of canary in the coal mine example of how we... are all sometimes compromising who we are.
It's really fun. It's like an exquisite joy when someone else uses a metaphor that you've been using for like years to talk about something. Like you're the first person who's ever said to me, like, and sort of intuited before I've said it, that like this canary in the coal mine thing, because I say that all the time, right? Mm. Like gender nonconforming people are the canary in the coal mine of gender,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if we go into the mine and we die, then it's not safe for anybody, and anyone who goes in there is going to get hurt,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's the reality, right? Like the suffering of trans people, the suffering of gender nonconforming people, it is absolutely something we must fix. But the way we fix it is by acknowledging that we are the extremity of the suffering, not the limit of it,
mm-hmm.
right? Like that we are suffering sort of the most perhaps under the system, but that everyone suffers under the system, right? The gender binary is bad for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of anyone having to sort of constrain themselves or contort their identity or sort of kill off parts of themselves that don't work.
Mm-hmm.
Like what it does for everybody is it detaches you from a sense of childlike play, from a sense of joy, and from a sense of self-expression that sustains actual fun in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Looping it back around to the theme.
Beam, 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 beam. I need to quickly interrupt this episode. So sorry.
Yeah, what's up?
So this episode is actually brought to you by ilovecreatives.com.
.com.
And we have lots of fun things on here, but we also have creative profiles. Do you know what our creative profiles is?
I know what a creative profile is.
So basically, it's our version of a resume, but it's kind of tricky when you're dealing with creatives that are slashies because you know, maybe you haven't defined it yet, but we like to think of it as a way to get to know you and see how you can help other creatives in the community. So yeah, you can see other people's creative profiles on there, or you can make one yourself and start building out your freelance service-based business or even small business.
Dang, that sounds great.
Yeah, well, thank
you. How do I get one?
You just got to go to iLoveCreatives.com and look for creative profiles in the navigation, and there you go.
Sounds great. I'm going to do that right now.
So as you were going through this journey, I would love to talk about what do you feel like your personality was? I feel like there's a lot of self-awareness at play here, but there was something that would always kind of get your compass of joy back aligned, even though all of these other things were kind of going, it was making it really hard to keep moving forward that way.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about, my like compass in terms of my life exploration, I think that my gender taught me a really valuable lesson, right? And that's the beauty of functioning anywhere on the margins, right? Is that you learn things from being marginalized. You learn things from having to navigate that shit. You learn things from learning to claim yourself that then steer you in other ways. And for example, for me, what that felt like was I feel like I spent from the age of like 15 to the age of 25, like unearthing my gender from a world that had kind of like buried it, you know, like taking my gender back from a world that said, you can't have that. And the sort of what I reconnected with was this question, this sort of central question of like, who was I? Who did I want to be when I was 4 years old?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
See, this is why the twinkle in your eyes, because that's literally my guidepost.
Right.
We're before just like, the world.
We're on some witchy wavelength.
Before
shit.
The world said, you know, no, you can't wear pink or whatever.
Right.
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 You wanted to, and then you learned that it was wrong, or you were told explicitly that it was wrong,
mm-hmm.
Right. Or made to feel subtly uncomfortable or outcast for doing a thing that totally felt great as you were walking out the door.
Right.
And I think I agree. I remember when Eva was helping me with Made with Map, mm-hmm. She was almost there for us to argue so that I could create a perspective. Or I feel like having something go against what I'm feeling helps me really quickly get into a position and like make a stance. Like, for example, when I was in college, I got an interview with Microsoft, didn't really like it anyways, but just was there because college, and they didn't like the way I was dressed. And I was like, I'm wearing J. Crew.
At Microsoft, you didn't like the way I was dressed?
I think it was the McCombs job counselor gave me notes and gave me a little pamphlet that had, you should wear a black pencil skirt with like a blazer. And I was like, nah.
You need to look sad.
Yeah. So then I cut off all my hair and I had a faux hawk. And I was like, who's going to hire me now?
I love that.
And that was it. Because I was so pissed. I was like, Oh, hell no.
Okay, so what you're saying is, if I'm hearing you right, that there is an element of your own self-expression and self-awareness that came as a result of antagonism.
Like, it's a rally.
You responded in a way that said, no, 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 no.
Tennis rally, sorry.
You're telling...
I was like, what?
A volley.
Oh, no, you know, like when you rally and you play.
I don't
you
know
hit.
How tennis works.
No, yeah, okay, so explain what a rally is.
So when you play and then you hit back and then you hit harder or you hit softer. But anyways.
Okay, okay.
All the tennis people already got it. They were like, I'm with this metaphor. And everyone else was like, I'm not going to bother to understand.
Right.
Okay.
So, but the point is that you doubled down when you were told to shut it down.
Right. I doubled down when, yeah.
They were like, shut it down. And you were like, no, I'm doubling down.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess that's what, you know, for me, when I think about what sort of is orienting my compass these days, it's like that question of who did I want to be when I was 4, before the world really got in there and fucked it up. That question kind of it started with my gender, but then it very quickly snowballed to like a bunch of other things, right? And I think that was also where I really got back in touch with what it meant to be an artist. Because I had spent my whole life being told that like being an artist is not a real job. Being an artist is you're going to have a miserable life. And also like it's not impressive. And like also I grew up in Raleigh, right? Like no one knew what it meant to be a professional. Well, I mean, there were some people who were like professional visual artists, but like no one knew what it meant to like do film and TV. No one knew what it meant to like, you know, do, I don't know. I wasn't around kind of the centers of cultural production where it's like actual job. It's an actual industry. It's a thing people do, right? It's a
not
political
even just
battleground.
What they do, but they strive to become it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's, you know, it's been this way of reconnecting with a bunch of different things I wanted. And that's one of the reasons why I think She-Ra has been so beautiful and being involved in an animated kids show. Although like, let's be real, like a significant portion of the audience are not children, including myself, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of people who watch it. But like, you know, being involved in an animated cartoon, being involved in something that's so playful, but also beautifully constructed and like really powerful in moments. It's just been like my 4-year-old self has just been like chortling like with glee the whole time, just like giggling their head off. Like this is the most fun we've ever had.
So did you have that sort of same kind of, I know we talked about the fun part, but this is like now on the other side of the coin. Mm. Did you have that sort of rising action antagonism that you were responding to, or was it that you were 4 years old and you like lost it like Peter Pan and then it was more like navigating your way back?
I think, you know, I guess it was a little bit of both. I was very gradual with my exploration. And there was a period of time where I did kind of get off on it feeling like a fuck you to other people. You know, like there was a period of time where I was like, yeah, I'm going to wear this fucking skirt and like, you're going to like, your eyes are going to bleed. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm going to wear this skirt and you're going to get a boner that you don't understand, frat boy. You know, like there were moments where I had that kind of energy about it, or
like a punk energy.
Right. Yes. Like a very punk energy. That was like my college gender was just punk. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, and I was, you know, like I'm going to wear this bright red lipstick and these torn up short jean short shorts and like these big ass stacked platform heels to the class where I just got 100 on the midterm and ruined the curve for all the people who want to go into finance after this class. You know? Yeah. And I walked in like, what's that? With my like lipstick tube, like the, like, you know, like the goth girl who's like secretly a genius in the high school movie or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, so there was a time when the opposition of it was like, so the thing that really like that felt vital and felt powerful for me. And then, you know, over time that faded. And then over time it kind of, because it was about me building my own self-confidence. There was a time where I thought, oh, like my gender is the thing that makes me interesting. And then, you know, over the course of a few years, I started to realize like, girl, you would still be interesting if you were cis.
Mm-hmm.
You'd still be talented if you were cis. You would just be better compensated and already own a house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
totally. Yeah.
No, I think that's a point that I like to highlight on too, is because I think even in like comedy or whatever, we have our story that we can lean on that's about our external narrative of what we look like and how that's played, and everyone has access to that.
Right.
And then there's a deeper story about exactly what you said of what makes us interesting outside of that, that in a certain way is even maybe not more special, but is intertwined with that like identity group specialness. Do you have a soapbox now that you want to what are you saying to the you know, the angsty 11-year-old self, the angsty 11-year-old Jacob out there that, you know, I don't know. Do you have a message for that person?
Mm. Well, I don't know if it's for my 11-year-old self, but I think it's totally. my more sort of general energy. I think it's sort of my like Saturn return energy, because I'm like sort of in the midst of that and I like really feel it, which also part of that is just about how our society is set up, right? Like when you get into your late 20s, there's just like things change and get weird for
and
a second.
People say that to you and then you're like, they are, aren't they?
Right. Yeah. And I feel like the way that that's manifested in my life, or whoa, manifested in my life, femifested, whatever. Like the way that that has sort of come to bear in my life, is, you know, that my shift is kind of going from, you know, everyone knows fake it till you make it, right? And my new energy, at least for 2020, is not fake it till you make it, but complain until you attain.
Yeah. Oh.
Say that one more time.
So I'm not doing fake it till you make it. I'm doing complain until you attain.
Complain until
you attain.
Ooh.
Break it down for us.
So I feel like one of the things that has been that's been really tough about the last 4 or 5 years is that I thought I needed to do this fake it until you make it thing, right? That I needed to, in order to move forward, I had to pretend like I already had everything I wanted, mm-hmm. and pretend that like everything I was doing was like the best thing, and
classic
pretend
classic 20-year-old,
right? And pretend also that I was being treated really well, right? And pretend that I was already getting all the treatment that I wanted and all that kind of stuff.
And you were turned out.
Mm-hmm. And what I had to realize is that, you know, if you don't name what you want and gripe about not having it, people don't know what you want and cannot help give it to you.
Yep.
Right? Like, I should have spent my entire, like, early 20s being like, where is my acting work? Where is my acting work? Why am I not getting cast and stuff? Why is this industry so hard to break into? Why is, like, why do you have to have so much money just, like, seed funding-wise to even get started? Like, why is this all so bad?
Because, you know, the feedback would have been, well, have you tried this? Have you tried, like, knowledge, suggestions, tips, support. Right.
Advice.
Right. And then the people who didn't care would be like, I'm over this person, peace. And you would know then also feedback who's not really on your team.
Right. And I think these days what I'm realizing is that I've done a lot of masking of sort of like what my actual lived experience has been in a lot of these sort of industries, right? And I think it's really important for me to name that there are beautiful exceptions to this rule, right? Like She-Ra and DreamWorks and Netflix being one of them, right? That like where I've had really good experiences in the industry. But for the most part, like, this industry treats non-binary and gender non-conforming people and trans people like trash. Right, like it's brutal and it's awful, and like the casting process is so arcane and so dated.
What's an example?
I mean, like I feel like many of my friends who are brilliant actresses, who are really well established, who are trans, still like they still cannot audition for roles that are not explicitly written as trans.
Oof, and then there's not that many. I mean, talk about trying to be an Asian right. actress. There's no way.
Right, and it's like people are still really invested in like. They think of, you know, the casting directors are still really invested in, like, they think of a woman and they're like, well, we couldn't cast a trans woman to play a cis woman, like, because then we'd have to rewrite the character as trans. And it's like, why?
Why?
Like, especially for some of these shows that don't even have, like, frontal nudity, like, it wouldn't even be, you know, like, I mean, and this is, you know, getting into, like, whether or not, you know, you've had bottom surgery, whether or not, like, you know, to what degree your transition has been medical, all that kind of stuff. But in general, it's like, most of the time, it's irrelevant.
But also, and if you have tattoos, they do what they need to do if right. that character doesn't have those tattoos.
Right. And also, like, there's just the idea that you couldn't sort of imagine a character as a woman and then, like, oh, she's incidentally trans, whatever. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Or, like, we don't think of her as trans, or she is, or we'll figure it out when we get there, right? That, like, these are things you can't just do. Like, that's so fucked up. And for me, you know, what I'm sort of learning to name, because it took me a long time to even suss it out. It took me a long time to even figure it out, is that, like, I, you know, the way that the sort of categories of roles that there are in Hollywood in terms of how other people preconceive their characters, right? There are cis men, there are cis women, right? There are trans men and trans women. And by that, they mean, like, gorgeous passing trans women and, like, built, jacked, hot trans dudes. Right. And then there are, like, non-binary roles. And by non-binary, they mean androgynous and hairless. And, like, you can't quite tell what the, you know, what the person is. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, you can't tell phenotypically, like, whether or not that you're looking at a male person or a female person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's taken me a long time to sort of name, like, within that schema, all I can audition to do is play cis men.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. I can't audition for non-binary roles because no one wants a hairy, like, non-androgynous person to play them. Mm. I can't audition to play women because no one will cast me as a woman.
Mm.
I would love to just, like, I'd be happy to play any role that was written for, like, for a woman, and, like, we'll figure it out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And especially when I had my long hair, it was like, yeah. And I sort of thought maybe, like, my long hair will, like, help me get into this. And then I was like, you're so naive, girl. Right? Like, you're so naive to think that people would be willing to be that expansive.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm feeling these days is, like, I spent so long trying to pretend like I already had the things I wanted because I thought that was how I would get them. that I didn't name the ways in which people were mistreating me and fucking me over. And so like now I need to name that, like, I deserve acting work, and likely the only way I'm going to get it is by making it for myself. And
yeah. I mean, you're doing this so well. I just want to highlight it. It's that your personal lived experience, when you do when you take up the practice of investigating that, mining that for experiences, you end up with stuff that
observations
that everyone can learn from.
Mm-hmm. Right.
On the self-awareness piece, what you're saying to me right now is not explicitly about gender non-conforming people. It's totally about...
It's much broader.
It's much broader application. So I just want to make sure people hear that and are like letting that sink in, you know?
Like the thing I feel I've learned from that is like watching both myself and all of my trans and queer friends try to sort of like make it in this industry and having real trouble and real barriers. I'm kind of like, yeah, maybe the principle in general should be that people who historically have had representation in this industry should not write characters specifically, like, should not sort of like write characters specifically like them, right? Mm. They should write characters that are general and that can be adapted,
sure.
Right? That adaptive casting and adaptive writing are actually the way this industry should go, right? I would be interested in being like, yeah, cis writers and directors should not explicitly think of their characters as cis anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, white showrunners should not think of their characters as explicitly white anymore. Right? Like I think that there's something, if you're writing of your community and your community has been historically marginalized, it's very different, right? Like, black showrunners should write black characters. That's badass, right? Like, queer showrunners should write queer characters. That's badass. But like, people who have been the dominant like modality of representation for decades, like, stop feeling like it's okay for you to just like exclude preemptively.
I also think there's room in casting to play with that still. When we look at, you know, I mean, for example, like Ariel being cast as a black girl,
which was such a badass decision.
Which in Disney's Little Mermaid, there's nothing about the character Ariel that says she has to be a white person.
Mm-mm.
Or she's actually not even a person in the human
sense.
She's a mermaid.
Yeah, she's non-human.
Mermaid.
Right. So it's like that, for example, that also could have been a gender non-conforming mermaid, because it's literally fins down at the bottom.
It makes sense that she's a redhead, though.
You know what I mean? Like, but that's also like, yeah, anyone could just have red
under
hair.
The surface of water because there's no sun. Anyways.
Oh, that was like biologic. I was like, I didn't get where that was coming from. And I was like, oh, you're like a zoologist. Got it. Cool.
Puno, one sec. I have to pause. The conversation is going really well because I neglected to tell you that, of course, I'm the founder and editor of citizensofculture.com. We're hosting this cool workshop called Soft Skills, which in relation to what we're talking about is really pertinent because it helps you with time management, prioritizing your day, and your collaborative practice. So if you're interested in that, go to citizensofculture.com and check out the Soft Skills workshop. You're going to love it.
You are going to love it. It's so soft. It's like the softest skills.
Oh, yeah. Like a baby's butt. Sorry. Back to what we were talking about.
All right, let's get back to
it.
Or so when we took the stand-up class, I thought, you know, what was happening was you were explaining some of these things through comedy.
Right.
Because it's the best way that people can not take it so seriously. Just look at it for what it is. I mean, because I feel like everything that you're doing in terms of how like your platform and even like doing a cartoon.
It's fun. It's all fun.
It's all fun.
Yeah.
It's like fun. Mm-hmm.
Right. And for me, what that's grounded in is not grounded in sort of dismissing the continued severity of the trans experience in America. Right. And around the world in many places, not everywhere, but in many places. Like, it's not about dismissing the pain or the trauma or the difficulty. It's about, for me, it's about like, A, I want to think about my own emotional health as a storyteller. And if I can't make jokes, I'm not healthy. I just know that about myself.
Right.
Right? Like, comedy is it's for me. Right? Like, and this is the thing that I get grumpy about is like, people read my book and it's funny and I'm cracking lots of jokes and they think I'm doing it for them. Like, they think that, like, I'm doing comedy as a way of apologizing for the politics that I'm presenting them, as a way of being like, look, I know that you don't want to hear about what non-binary people think, so I'm just going to make some cute jokes so that maybe you'll listen a little more.
Right.
Right? Like, they think that's why it's happening.
It's not for palatability.
No, it's not for palatability. It's not like sugar to make the medicine go down. Comedy is my own medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, comedy is how I transcend what were sometimes very shitty circumstances. Comedy is how I heal myself and get above things that really hurt me, right? Like, if I, like, and this was the challenge I posed to myself when I was writing my book. I was like, I am not going to recount any experience or any story. There's one exception, but in general, I'm not going to recount any experience or any story without finding the joke in what happened or the jokes in what happened, because it makes me get above the experience, look at it from a place of power, and be able to say, I'm healed enough from this that I can look at the mechanics and laugh at some of what happened. And laughter is like the best medicine for healing your own shit.
I feel like one of the things that I really appreciate about your gift is that you're able to say things that are, to me, really prophetic in plain language. You know, like, it isn't for palatability, but it is palatable. And it's not palatable because you've stripped it of meaning or intention or whatever. It's palatable because you're speaking at it from a place of, I guess I'm putting this in your mouth, of what I'm reading is, I'm interpreting it that you're speaking from a place of, I'm a human being, this is my story, boom. You're a human being.
Boom. There was a gesture that went along with that for all the listeners.
Yep.
It was like a sort of like right angle wrist, like with like a flat hand.
Yeah, it was
that then sort of like skates really fast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's literally the curdling emoji version of a hand, right?
Yes.
Like the sliding across the ice. Human to human, ice hockey.
Yes.
Or air hockey.
Yeah.
Or
it's like an air hockey thing.
It's definitely an air hockey thing.
Yeah, more air hockey.
That's like, it's cool that you picked up on that in that way, because that's the other thing that when I think about getting in touch with my 4-year-old self, like, and getting in touch with like really who I am at my core, I spent a long time, cause you know, I like went to like Duke for undergrad and like was, you know, was very around like a lot of like academia, blah, 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 blah. And I learned to speak that language cause I thought I had to perform it. And what I've come to sort of really own is like at my core, like in my heart of hearts, I'm just kind of like North Carolina suburban mediocre person.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I never want to not be that. Like, I don't want to speak in fancy ways that like that someone working at Waffle House in Fuquay's Arena could not understand, right? Like, I don't want to speak in a way that like is not accessible to like, you know, if I'm just chilling at the farmer's market in Raleigh, right? Like, I don't want to speak in a way that like deliberately sort of performs this like erudite, like fancy academic bullshit when this shit isn't that complicated.
Mm-hmm. It's people
right.
stuff.
Ooh.
That was so well said that magic literally came down.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Wait, oh yeah, all the things. Where should we find you?
Oh, I'm just at Jacob Tobia on like everything.
Spell it though, because you have
J-A-C-O-B-T-O-B-I-A. That's it.
Hey.
Look at Muad'Dib's little butthole.
Mm-hmm. It's cute. Well, that was a fun episode.
They all are.
So if you felt that way too, we would love it if you could Maceo, could you tell them what they should do?
If you could just go ahead and drop us a million stars, or as many as you think are worthy, as a little review, and maybe tell us what you liked about it.
Yeah, and then our parents will be proud of us.
I can feel it already.
Mm-hmm.
thank you.
It's fun
with Puno
and Maceo. Maceo and Puno.
It's Puno and Maceo.
Whatever.